We love really it's just not as so
this is Solidarity Journal. Share in a common voice. Just might find your own.
To think that this was John Doe.
It's like the argument about the argument in part. No, we fought an entire goddamn war. States' right to do what?
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in.
It's Tuesday, July 19th. I'm Michael Perillo, and for today I'll be filling in for Zach at the Solidarity Journal. Today's show will contain our second segment of coverage at the past Socialism Conference in Chicago, with speakers Omar Bregoli talking about boycott, divestment, sanctions, a global movement for the Palestinian struggle against the apartheid state of Israel. And Ali Abu Nima, editor at Electronic Intifada, talks about what Palestinians are doing and how the international community is helping out while facing Israel and the United States' oppressive measures to stop them. We'll also hear from Eric Cobb, the executive director of the Building Trade Union in South Central Wisconsin, who will talk about what it's going to take to get unions to represent the workers and forming a new party that represents them. Also, Samantha Jordan, member of Wisconsin Resist, will give her assessment of the Wisconsin labor movement and how the austerity measures against the working class need to be fought back. And at the home front, we have the recent WHOI-WEEK Day of Reckoning rally, where Gary Moore and many other community workers and leaders are fighting back against a dangerous contract being proposed on them that could outsource Peoria's local news, weather, and public affairs, and how you can help in getting the word out to stop this. So stay tuned and prepare to be radicalized.
Shame on
management!
Shame on
WEEK!
Shame on
WHOI!
Shame on
management!
Shame on
Granite!
Shame on
Silver Point!
Shame on
Granite!
Shame on
Silver Point!
When in doubt,
take it out!
When in doubt,
this past Saturday, Gary Moore, an anchor of News 25 Today in Central Illinois, and president of the local AFTRA chapter, led the WHOI-WEEK Day of Reckoning rally in response to the recent contract that the general manager, Mark DeSantis, along with a hedge fund group called Silverpoint, which is run by a couple of former Goldman Sachs people, are agreeing on without the agreement of the workers at the broadcasting station. The language within this contract would give the GM the power to outsource the news, weather, and public affairs to another city, even another state. So the chanting you just heard, when in doubt, take it out, refers to the contract, and if DeSantis says he'll never use that power to outsource our local news, then it should not be in the contract at all. The rally started at the UAW Local 974 Hall, and turned into a march down to the WHOI-WEEK station, where DeSantis drove off in his car away from the protesters. Here, Gary Moore explained how this all came about, and why the forestalling in February on this contract is now becoming a dangerous reality.
This contract, as some of you might know who've been following this labor struggle, includes in it the right for the management of the station to outsource news and weather. They tried it before by having weather done from Fort Wayne, Indiana on the weekends, where the guy was saying San Joe's and mispronouncing Chillicothe and forecasting weather that was calling for sunny skies when we had severe storms. We filed a grievance and we won our case. An arbitrator ruled in our favor that what they did was bogus. Now they are trying to put that language in our contract. And tomorrow, come 12:01 a.m., they will have the authority to do that. Do you want your weather outsourced?
No!
Do you want your news outsourced?
No!
Do you want your public affairs shows outsourced?
No!
But tomorrow they will have the authority to do that. And so today is a day of reckoning.
Mike Everett, president of the West Central Building Trade, spoke about the attack by the mainstream media, owned by the corporate sector, that has an agenda to keep most listeners in the dark, and how we can not allow such attacks on our local broadcasting.
I hope, I think they're banking that we're not paying that close of attention. I think they're counting on the fact that we're not paying enough attention that we won't notice when our news becomes imported. When we won't notice when our news is not professional and not authentic, and those aren't our neighbors doing the news anymore, when it becomes a bunch of BS. They're thinking that we won't notice. And there's a day of reckoning in this country, and I can only pray, and I mean pray, that a lot more people are paying attention to what's going on nationally as it's being exposed. What happens to a country, what happens globally when one guy like Rupert Murdoch can control so much information? It's dangerous. It's dangerous, folks. It's happening right here to our friends. It's dangerous nationally, and we're seeing that it's dangerous globally. It's against the law. It's evil. It has to come to the end. But they're banking that you're not paying enough attention. Well, I know the folks that are here have been paying attention. You are paying attention, but we need to talk to our friends. We need to talk to our brothers and sisters in the labor movement. We need to never tolerate what's going on here. We need to fight this every step of the way. We need to stand with these folks. This imposed contract, it is not a contract when both parties don't agree to it. These are new rules and regulations imposed or force-fed to this group. This is not a contract. That's what happens when corporations run your information. That's what happens when corporations gobble up all your news. That's what happens when they own the newspapers, the radio stations, the television stations. When they own it all like Murdoch does, it's evil. And it has to come to an end. The Labor Council of West Central Illinois stands in solidarity with these people fighting for their jobs. But they're fighting for WEK jobs, WHOI jobs, sorry. But they are fighting for something that is far more important than that in this country. And actually, they're fighting for the truth on a global scale. It is a lot bigger than what's happening here in Central Illinois. And we will not tolerate it. We will fight it every step of the way, regardless of what it takes.
Bloomington rep for the labor movement, Mike Matika, came to the rally in solidarity with the workers. He reminded everyone how communities need our help to stand together when it is under attack.
Stand together, support each other, we shop at each other's stores, we have decent jobs, and we take care of each other. And part of having a community is having a news system and an information system that's rooted in and reflects our community. And that's why it's so important we defend these workers, and even though they may look like stars to us on TV, they're still workers, they still earn a paycheck, they still have a union contract, and they still deserve a right to that contract. And so that's why we're out here today, and that other word is solidarity. Look around this crowd, look at the community groups, look at the different unions. We stand together, we support each other, because we can only have a strong community if we're a solid community. And we got to put our hearts and our minds and talk to our friends and neighbor in our community to support our news programs in our community and to keep these folks strong.
Mark Strauss, a sports anchor at WHOI-WEK, tells everyone how this type of attack has happened before with Channel 19 and that it will eventually happen to WHOI.
The engineers, reporters, photographers, producers, with the exception of maybe one or two, are gone. Granted, when they swallowed up Channel 19 with the shared services agreement, swept them all out the door. In fact, there was a policeman there that day that told them they had to leave. Did you even get to empty your desk? No, they didn't even get to empty their desk. That's what Silver Point does. They've done it before.
We lost all of our engineers but one, who was at WEK before all this started.
IBEW.
All but one. So they swept them out the door. Well, history's a good teacher. They did it to Channel 19. They did it to our engineers. And we're next. We're all that's left. We're the last target. It's coming.
Dave Kaler, the senator of the 46th District of Peoria, made an appearance at the rally, showing his frustration with this contract being pushed on the union and workers.
When is enough enough? You know, when is enough enough? I mean, you're messing with our lives in Central Illinois. All we want to do is be able to give a day's work for a day's pay and live our life with our families and make this community as good and as strong as we can. I mean, that's what we've done for generations. And now all of a sudden, because of greed, really, what else is it? It's greed. We see that there are strategies that really don't take us into account as people. Certainly they don't take the workers into account. All these folks that have, we know these names. We watch them every day. You know, these are the people that that we live our lives with. You know, on TV. This is part of our community. So when is enough enough? It's important that we stand in solidarity with our brothers and sisters from Channel 25, Channel 19, because this thing is not going to stop unless we stop it. And so that's our commitment to you, is we are going to help you stop it.
And then at one point, Gary Moore faces the crowd and talks about what the union and workers will resort to if this contract does go through.
So we do have a plan, we do have a strategy, and we do have some things up our sleeve, we do have some cards to play. There's probably a big joker and a little joker that I can't speak too much about, but I can tell you about some of the aces. Well, we've talked about the Twitter campaign, we've talked about the billboards, we talked about getting our lawmakers involved, etc. There are a couple other cards that we can play, and they have to do with our advertisers at the station. Now, this is a card that we are holding back on, because this is a very powerful card to ask advertisers, people who spend their money with the station, to pull their advertising from the station. But we might be forced to do that if the company imposes this contract on us in a way that is egregious and negative. The last thing would be a strike or walkout. The company, of course, can lock us out. That might happen also. And I want you all to be aware of that possibility. Hopefully it won't come to either of those things. Us asking the advertisers to pull and us being on strike or being locked out. That's why today is a day of reckoning. And we're hopeful that the company will see the light and that these realities that we're experiencing now is as worse as it gets.
For more information, please check out the Twitter campaign at www.aftra.com/savelocalnews.
All right.
At this year's socialism conference, many turned out to hear prominent speakers like Ali Abu Nima and Omar Bogoti speak about the Palestinian struggle and how we can be more effective and help the Palestinians get their self-determination and end the racist and colonial structure in the Israel. Similar types of apartheid that South Africans went through for 30 years before receiving equal rights after boycotting. Ali Abu Nima, a Palestinian-American journalist and co-founder of Electronic Intifada, talks about the ongoing Arab uprisings and how they are not only anti-imperial revolutions, but anti-Israel uprisings as well, which go against the brutal and slow genocide of the Palestinian people. But these mass uprisings show how powerless Israel is when it doesn't have its neighboring countries stopping refugees from returning to their homeland.
The Palestinian people, well, one thing we heard from our comrades in Egypt and in many other countries who have been working on the ground for many years to build the organizing and to build the movement that created this uprising and this ongoing revolution, that they always took inspiration from the struggle of the Palestinian people. And you can tell the true revolutionaries in Egypt because they're the ones who are also standing up for Palestine. There were some media figures, I won't name names, who were going around saying, oh, you know, the people in Tahrir Square, they don't care about Palestine. You know, this isn't an anti-Israel revolution, but you know, it can't be anti-imperial without taking on Israel. You can't support the uprisings of the Arab peoples if you support Israeli occupation and apartheid and don't stand up to it. So it's very important to be very clear about where we stand on the Arab revolts and on Palestine. And we've seen that the Arab uprisings have been received as a real threat by Israel. The Israeli press is full of op-eds. It was full of op-eds for weeks, mourning the overthrow of Mubarak. And now, by the way, they're very worried for Bashar al-Assad in Syria, because, you know, despite the rhetoric, in fact, Syria kept borders with the Israeli-controlled borders of Palestine totally quiet.
That's right.
And what we saw with the Nakba Day, the May 15th protests, was the potential. You know, tens of thousands of people came to the borders in Lebanon and in the occupied Golan Heights. Not the borders of Israel, as the media were reporting, but the ceasefire line between Syrian-controlled Syrian territory and Israeli-occupied Syrian territory. And Israel, with the full endorsement of the Obama administration, opened fire, killing dozens of people. This, by the way, is after Obama came to Cairo in 2009 and urged people to engage in non-violent protest and take the example of the civil rights marches. Well, those were people marching for their civil and human rights. And now, just yesterday, there was an article in the Israeli press, or the day before yesterday, the headline was IDF powerless against mass uprising in Palestinians. That they know that without these Arab regimes keeping the Palestinian people and Arab people down on behalf of Israel and the United States, that 1 million, 2 million Palestinians could get up and walk home. The struggle is there on the ground, and it takes many, many forms in Palestine and in the region. The steadfastness of Palestinians on the ground is incredible. From the Galilee to Gaza, from the Negev Desert, the Naqab to Nazareth, the ethnic cleansing that is continuing to go on of Bedouin, Israel's recently announced plan for a new Trail of Tears to remove 40,000 Bedouin from their land in the Naqab, the last shreds of land that they hold. The same is going on throughout Palestine. But after 63 years, the spirit of Palestinians on the ground is absolutely unbroken. The spirit... We are at a moment now where we see the utter bankruptcy of the political system in this country as a vehicle for progressive change on any issue. But if we want this change to happen, we're going to have to go out and do it ourselves, just like they're doing it in Egypt. When it comes to Palestine, the most important contribution that all of us can make right now in this country is to educate ourselves about the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, BDS, to know the arguments, to know how to answer them, and to get involved in campaigns everywhere that we are. Thank you very much.
That was Ali Abu Nima giving a great talk on the Arab uprisings and the Palestinian struggle for self-determination and a right to exist and live on their stolen land. Omar Borgodi, a founding committee member of the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, and a founding member of the BDS campaign, gave a discussion on the most important contribution we can do to stop the brutal occupation and destruction of the Palestinian culture.
BDS is certainly a very nonviolent movement, by definition. It's calling for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. It is inspired by a long history of Palestinian struggle against settler colonialism and occupation, and also by the South African anti-apartheid movement. The most important factor that has affected the Palestinian BDS movement is the South African anti-apartheid struggle, to a lesser extent the civil rights movement in the US and the Indian revolution against the British, Gandhi. But it's mainly inspired, rooted in Palestinian civil resistance. What is BDS? Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions is a call that came out from Palestinian civil society in 2005. It was endorsed immediately by the great majority of Palestinians, represented by trade unions, women's groups, student groups, political parties, just about everyone. And when we say Palestinians, unlike what the media tells you, it's not those in the West Bank and Gaza only. It's the Palestinians, those in exile, the majority of the Palestinians, Palestinian citizens of Israel, the 48 Palestinians, and so on. Those are the three segments of the Palestinian people, not just those in the occupied West Bank, Gaza, including East Jerusalem. So it was endorsed largely by a great majority of the Palestinian people, and it called for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, but that's not the key part. The key part in the BDS call was the three rights that we focused on. The three rights, the minimal rights, without which we cannot, as a people, exercise our right to self-determination. The first right is ending the occupation and colonization of the 1967 territory, including the wall, the settlements, and so on. The second, ending the system of racial discrimination in Israel, which is a form of apartheid, and I'll talk a bit more about that. The third, and the most important, is the right of return for refugees. Without that, we won't have the minimal ability to exercise our right to self-determination, not just because the refugees are at the very core of the question of Palestine, but simply they are the majority. People who say we are in solidarity with the Palestinians, but we just want to focus on the occupation, we just want to oppose the occupation. You know, that right of return is a bit tricky and it gets into Jewish state and whatnot. I'd rather not get into that. Those persons are not in solidarity with the Palestinian people. They're in solidarity with themselves or with Israel. They want to save apartheid Israel. They want to get rid of the occupied territories simply because it has 4 million Palestinians that Israel would love to get rid of, but after grabbing most of their fertile lands and water aquifers and so on. So that's not a Palestinian solidarity agenda. That's an Israeli apartheid solidarity agenda. Let me put it plainly. So we can understand people who support our basic rights, but then say, I want to focus in my work on the occupation. That's perfectly fine. That's different. People say we support ending occupation, apartheid, and we support the right of return, but in my daily work, on my BDS work, I want to focus on settlements only. I want to focus on Ahava, a cosmetics company that manufactures in a colony in the occupied territories. That's perfectly fine. So when it comes to the tactics of BDS, the boycotting, the divesting, and the pushing government for sanctions, those are tactical considerations that depend on your context. Activists decide what to pick as targets and how to pursue working on that target. We defer to activists and we respect their decisions, how best to do BDS. Where we insist, what we insist on are the three basic rights. That is not negotiable. And again, that's up to the Palestinians to decide, not anyone in the solidarity movement. But so why would anyone, you know, spend any time in her or his busy schedule to do anything for Palestine? Really? I mean, other than the most progressive. Well, first, it's a moral duty. As taxpayers, you're directly responsible for our misery. Israel's occupation, apartheid, cannot possibly continue without your tax money. It's just impossible. Israel is powerful economically, militarily. It's the fourth, fifth most strongest army in the world, nuclear power, and so on. But it cannot sustain its occupation, militarization, and apartheid without U.S. tax money. So there's a direct responsibility that comes with that terrain. Since your tax money is being abused by your government to sustain apartheid in Palestine, then there's a responsibility that comes with that. So let me address some of the key issues, some of the basic arguments that come up against BDS. Saying that BDS against Israel is anti-Semitic is an anti-Semitic statement itself, because it assumes that Israel and all Jews are one and the same. As if all Jews are one monolithic lot that thinks alike, and all of them support Israel. Israel speaks for them. So if you attack Israel, you're attacking the Jews. Some in Israel are, of course, talking about the rise of fascism. Jewish Zionist Israelis, theater people, academics, and so on, are talking about the rise of fascism. In fact, they have a declaration of independence from fascism signed by some 160 top academics and cultural figures in Israel, that say Israel is fast descending into fascism. One of the most important award-winning academics in Israel, Gabriel Solomon, went as far as comparing today's Israel to Germany in the 1930s. He said, quote, "The idea of Judenrein, a Jew-free zone, or Arab Rhine is not new. Some might say, how can you compare us to Nazis?" And he says, "I'm not talking about the death camps, but about the year 1935. There were no camps yet, but there were racist laws. And we're heading forward toward these kinds of laws in Israel. The government is clearly declaring our incapacity for democracy." End of quote. Other than anti-Semitism, the issue of delegitimizing Israel as a Jewish state. Let me set the record straight. Palestinians and Arabs in general have never, will never, recognize Israel as a Jewish state, because that will be the end of our right to self-determination. It's just impossible. Any state that insists on being racist and exclusionary cannot demand that people recognize it. No state has a right to be a racist state. No state. Islamic state, Christian state, Hindu state, as long as it's exclusionary, it is racist and it should be resisted. We should never accept any exclusionary state, not even a Jewish state. Plus, this is an extraterritorial definition of nationality that defies international law. Any of you who knows about international law's definition of nationality, and so this is totally infringing international laws on nationality. There's no such thing as extraterritorial nationality. And Israel is the only country on earth that does not recognize Israeli nationality. It does not recognize its own nationality. It recognizes Jewish nationality, whatever that means, plus 130 others, but not Israeli nationality. Some lefty Zionists tried to go to the Supreme Court to get the Supreme Court to recognize them as Israeli nationals rather than Jewish nationals. They said, "We're secular atheists. We don't want to be recognized as Jews. We want to be Israelis." And the Supreme Court shut that down. They refused. The Knesset has refused. The governments have refused. It's just not acceptable, because that would mean a semblance of equality. If you have Israeli nationality, that means Arabs and Jews are equal. And that's the last thing Israel can afford, giving equality, God forbid, to Palestinians.
That was Omar Borgodi speaking on BDS. Recently, Knesset passed a law by a 47-38 vote that would make any boycotting in Israel illegal. The bill stipulates that any person who initiates, promotes, or publishes material that might serve as grounds for imposing a boycott on Israel or the Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem is committing an offense. And if found guilty of such an offense, that person may be ordered to compensate parties economically affected by the boycott, including reparations of 30,000 Israeli shekels, which equals out to about $8,700, without an obligation on the part of the plaintiffs to prove damages. So supposedly states that pride themselves on democracy have to pass laws that destroy democracy. But more importantly, this shows the desperation that the state of Israel and its Zionist leadership is feeling in response to the effectiveness of the BDS movement. And Omar shares how it has worked so far. To learn more, please visit the BDS website at bdsmovement.net, or you can pick up Omar's book, BDS Boycott Divestment Sanctions, The Global Struggle for Palestinian. Next, we have Eric Cobb, executive director of the Buildings Trade Union in South Central Wisconsin, talking about his views on the union and how workers and unions need to move away from the over-conservatism in the workforce and the Democratic parties that do not show the same interests as the working class. How collective bargaining rights are human fundamental rights that every person should have, and how union people worked with non-union people in trying to protect these rights in Wisconsin. Eric speaks a language that most workers and those of us who are struggling understand. His main message is that you and I are the union. We are the movement, and we are what makes things happen. And if we do nothing to stop this and let our bosses and managers run over us without a fight, it'll obviously never stop. And so, Wisconsin was us fighting back.
And I joined the union because there was solidarity in there. And I realize that I have an idealistic view of what unionism is, because I experience a lot of anti-unionism within the union movement every single day. As a building trades guy, I see building trades going against each other. Mm-hmm. Trades fighting each other for work, for jurisdictional disputes, trying to get each other kicked off of the job site. We have a very serious disconnect here, and a very serious over-conservatism in the labor movement and in the union movement, and particularly in the building trades. So again, people ask me, what the hell are you doing to the building trades? I'm saying, I'm dragging you kicking and screaming into the 21st century. I really enjoy talking to my brothers and sisters out in the field. Oftentimes they have the conversation of, what's the union done for me? You hear that conversation a lot. I said, well, what about your rate of pay? Well, besides that. Well, what about your health insurance? Well, besides that. What about your pension? Well, besides that. Well, what about me standing right next to you, and if you're a fan, I'm here for you? Well, besides that. Well, brother, let me tell you something. You're the union, and I'm the union, and us standing together is that union. It is the labor movement. And unless you really wrap your head around that and you get beyond the idea that the union is this invisible entity off in outer space over here that you give $30 a month to for your dues, and you hope that they're there for you when you need them in a grievance situation or to negotiate that next concessionary contract, then you're going to stay where you are. And the only way to combat that is for you to become active and for you to get into your union and actually get some stuff done. Now, when we talk about collective bargaining rights, we can take it another step up and say, these are actually First Amendment rights. This is my freedom of speech. This is my freedom to assemble with my brothers and sisters. So therefore, it should be a First Amendment right, and no question that we're bargaining together. Now, the beauty of what happened in Wisconsin with that labor movement was we were able to branch beyond the building trades, us fighting against each other, and I would have an operating engineer standing next to a laborer, standing next to a sheet metal worker, standing next to somebody else that might have been stealing his work the week before, and completely forgetting about that for that time being, because we saw this as a much larger movement. We saw union people standing next to non-union people, and those non-union people turning to the union and saying, what is collective bargaining? I'm curious, what does that mean? And then when you give them that simple explanation, they say, well, what's wrong with that? I would like that, actually. And you have them turning us against each other, a very classic move here. One of the first things Walker said was, the haves and the have-nots, meaning that the public sector workers were the haves and the private sector workers weren't. So there's that wedge, right? And we look at it and we laugh at it today, the people in this room, but you take that average Wisconsinite and they're like, well, yeah, they have all these really special items here and I should be able to have, or instead of saying I should be able to have that, they say, well, if I don't have it, they shouldn't have it either. Well, again, using an old building trades line, bullshit. Really, what I want to do, I really want to elevate the conversation beyond all of our individual interests. I don't have any problem with everyone's individual interests, whether it's union, non-union, immigrant rights, or LGBT, or whatever it is. Those are all battles well worth fighting, but I think that we can forge all of our battles together into what I consider to be human rights, civil rights, and constitutional rights battles. And that's really where we are today. And that's really where I feel that this battle needs to go. And that is really where I think that we can get everybody on board under the same banner and say, these are human rights violations, these are civil rights violations, and these are constitutional rights violations. And when we start to elevate that conversation to that level, it's very difficult for somebody to say, no, I don't agree with you on that. And if we can exploit that as best we can and get out and educate people and organize people as best we can, I think that's going to be our best angle on that. And that goes to my final point. I've been to dozens of these things, and I really appreciate being invited to them, and I love speaking to people about the revolution and about fighting for the labor movement. But I want to see some movement. I don't want to see any more talks anymore. We've talked so much, and I've heard so many history stories about so many historic union battles, and it's all beautiful and it's all wonderful, but we need to see some motion here, folks. And I said it in Ohio last weekend, and I'll say it again today. I'm tired of asking. Mm-hmm. It's time that we demand what we want. Let's move forward with that. And let's take that demand and say, this is what we want. We demand the rights to collectively bargain. We demand the rights to honor free speech. We demand the rights to put forth legislation or whatever else we want in order to get the things that we want and deserve. No more cuts, no more concessions. We know where the money is. Let's go get it. Yeah.
I had the pleasure of listening and speaking with Samantha Jordan with Root Wisconsin Resist. Samantha talked about the movement and occupation of the Capitol building in Madison, Wisconsin.
The power that you felt inside the occupation, inside the Capitol, what happened in the rest of the community was even more astounding. There wasn't a place that you could go in Madison where the talk wasn't about the bill, it wasn't about what was going on in the Capitol. Everywhere you went, every restaurant, every parking garage, you know, it was like that everywhere. And it was so funny because I remember reading, you know, years ago, you know, the first time I read 10 Days to Shook the World, which is a sort of a document of the Russian Revolution. There's a scene where, you know, John Reed talks about what Moscow was like right after the revolution, and that everywhere you went, under every light post, people were, you know, talking politics and you know, discussing strategy. And Madison really became that. I mean, the evolution of the movement was quite inspiring. But of course, you know, here we are 5 months later, and we didn't win. So what happened and why? You know, the defeat that we suffered was actually pretty substantial. The governor did succeed in passing what's probably the most draconian budget in the history of the state of Wisconsin. It includes $900 million in cuts to education, $550 million in cuts to Medicaid, erosion of Badger Care, which is a public health program, and they say that up to 70,000 Wisconsinites will be without health insurance by the end of the next biennium, and it just goes on and on and on. I mean, he even attacked craft beer, which is crazy in a state of Wisconsin, but through Miller Coors negotiated a deal where, like, small microbreweries will no longer be able to sell their wares in grocery stores. And for state workers, I mean, you know, this is going to be a harsh couple of years. With the passage of Act 10, they no longer have collective bargaining rights of any kind. If they want to even maintain union status, they have to have a recertification election where they win the vote of 50% plus one of all workers in their bargaining units, and they have to do this every single year to maintain their existence. And in terms of the amount of money that they're going to lose as far as a pay cut, they will relinquish anywhere from $2,000 to $10,000 per year in deferred compensation with the increased contributions in their health care and pensions. And this is a really, really mighty concession. I mean, state workers in Wisconsin, on average, make less than $45,000 a year. So that's a lot of money. And it's, the Wisconsin uprising really does illustrate some of the strengths, but also the limitations of a spontaneous uprising. Because the reality was, as beautiful and powerful as it was spontaneous, and there was no real organization underneath. And it also really illustrates the timidity of big labor and their unwillingness to change strategy and tactics. I mean, the fact is they pursued, you know, a service model of organizing within unions and an electoral strategy for more than 40 years. And what has it meant for the American workforce? Our numbers of unionized workers have gone down steadily. Because I think the one thing, and I think this is an important thing to take out of what happened in Wisconsin, is that we are forever changed. Even though we lost, it doesn't mean that the fight's not over. And everywhere in the city of Madison and across the state of Wisconsin, people are beginning to organize. You know, what happened over the course of the 5 months really did raise the question, what is it going to take to win? What does need to be done? And there is a real widespread recognition that we need to begin to organize ourselves, that the collective power that we showed in the Capitol, that self-organization that we had during the Capitol occupation, is something that we need to repeat in our workplaces and in our communities, and that we actually need to collectively fight and cannot depend on those that we elect to lead us, be they labor leaders or elected politicians.
And in your speaking the other day, what was it that you're trying to kind of get people push onto, or not push, but, you know, kind of get people to see on the one-sided class, and also what the unions may need to be doing to change or cut off ties with Democratic parties in Madison, and how to move away from what the Democratic Party has become?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things in Madison is we had this wonderful, wonderful spontaneous uprising in Wisconsin, massive protests that went on for more than a month, and they were deliberately de-escalated by state AFL-CIO and the Democratic Party. And unfortunately, to focus people into, recall elections. Now, I agree, I've got no problems with the recall. I think that actually, you know, all the legislators that voted in favor of the budget, it's incredibly draconian, do deserve to lose their jobs, as well as those who voted to end collective bargaining. And I think that the governor deserves to lose his job. I think that, you know, recalling them would be a great lesson for them. However, I think that recall elections should be part of a larger strategy. And one of the problems that we found in Madison is that as they funnel people into solely working on canvassing for the recalls, fewer and fewer people were coming out to protest. And I think that there was sort of a misguided, notion in that with AFL-CIO that somehow there wasn't a positive correlation between the masked street protests and the visibility of the movement and the recall campaign. And in fact, they had a much more difficult time getting volunteers for the recall campaign once they started to de-escalate the street movement. I mean, I think that one of the points I was trying to make in the talk was that Madison was significant because there really has been a one-sided class warping wage in this country for more than a generation. What we're seeing in Madison is really the result of more than a generation of neoliberal policies. You're also seeing it nationally with, you know, this move to austerity. And I think it was significant in that people just finally said, okay, we've hit the line in the sand and we're not taking this anymore. When the protests started, they really were around collective bargaining, but as they progressed, you know, people began to understand that they were really part of a much larger global movement, people fighting really to maintain a decent standard of living and, you know, understanding the hypocrisy of, you know, giving banks a $750 billion bailout, you know, just 2 years ago. their hard-earned money being transferred to the wealthiest institutions in society, who are the ones who are responsible for the recession that we're currently in, and yet there was absolutely no provisions, you know, for working people. You know, we still have millions of people who are losing their homes due to foreclosure. Unemployment is still close to 10%. Rural unemployment is much higher than that. You know, and that the social programs and whatnot that are being cut by the current administration are things that are very, very necessary to people, and that there needs to be a much more fair distribution of wealth. We need to start taxing the wealthy and corporations. We really don't have a financial crisis in this country, and I think people are recognizing that and starting to actually, you know, push back, which I think is a good thing. And I think that, for me, is the importance of Madison, the meaning of Madison, that, you know, working people are not going to take it anymore. We're not going to see our hard-earned dollars being transferred to the wealthiest in society. We're now going to start making demands of our administration and the institutions that run this country and try and get our due.
And that involves also getting people more active in nonviolent direct action as well, to a much more degree, like in Madison and Michigan and Ohio and New Jersey or whatever other state where a lot of this is taking place right now.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, Wisconsin Resists and some of the other coalitions that I mentioned, like U.S. Uncut and the Labor Community Network, you know, one of the reasons that we did move into, you know, arena of sort of direct action is to, you know, to keep people active on the streets, but also, you know, nonviolent civil disobedience is a very powerful tool. You know, civil rights, you know, that's the reason we have them. Women's rights, that's the reason we have them. And, you know, I think that we need to have more than just simply street protests. There needs to be more direct action. Had, you know, people actually physically blocked the assembly, we might not have, you know, the budget that we have in the state of Wisconsin. Unfortunately, that wasn't the case, but what we're trying to do now is sort of, you know, assess what happened in Wisconsin and reorganize ourselves so the next battle we can win.
That Wisconsin Resist does.
Wisconsin Resists is a labor community activist network. We originally got together during the when the emergency budget repair bill was announced in the state of Wisconsin, and we called ourselves the Kill the Whole Bill Coalition. At the time, most people knew about the collective bargaining piece of the budget repair bill, but there's a whole lot of other things in the bill as well that were pretty awful. So we thought it would be good to have a group that sort of tried to raise some awareness about the totality of the budget. We changed our name to Wisconsin Resists. I'd say a couple weeks into the event, and basically we do direct action and then educationals. So you know, we had a big teach-in on austerity with a group called Wisconsin Wave for their people's, it was like the People's Convention or something like that, and then a couple other subsequent teach-ins, and then we do a lot of direct action work. We participated with another labor community organization called the Labor Community Network around a series of reverse Robin Hood actions, you know, where we did direct actions at a series of banks in Madison and managed to shut them down. We've also done some work with U.S. Uncut in a similar vein, and then obviously participating in the demonstrations at the Capitol, as well as participating in May Day, help building that.
And from being there myself, there's a misconception sometimes with the Madison movement, and it is how it started. Some people think that it was the unions who got workers involved and organized and started moving them about around the state, holding solidarity protests statewide. Which is partially true, except that's not exactly what started or how it started. What started it all was the teachers and the students in Madison. In mid-February, the students at four different high schools walked out of school and went to the Capitol building in Madison. The teachers watched this and joined them, even holding the doors open for them to the Capitol building. This eventually forced the teachers' union to follow in suit after 30% of the teachers' workforce in Wisconsin called in sick, which, let's be honest, was basically a strike. So this caught on like wildfire and led to the occupation and mass movement there in Wisconsin. The same can be said for the 14 senators who left Wisconsin and went into hiding in Illinois, so they couldn't take a vote and push through Governor Walkner's bill. Those senators didn't leave on their own accord. They were forced by 15,000 protesters who blocked the assembly doors in the initial days of the occupation. Now, it doesn't take a genius to figure this out,
But if there's thousands of people not wanting you to be passive and let someone vote away your rights, you're probably not going to go break through that line of 15,000 people and let that vote happen. So it wasn't the union leadership or Democrats who started this. It was the workers. It was from the ground up. And that's probably the most important thing to take away from all of this. And that is that we have this power to make a difference. So that about does it for today's show. Please make sure and visit wearemany.org for videos from this year's socialist conference and previous years as well. And on that note, thanks for tuning in to the Solidarity Journal, where you can get all your local community exposés and events.
Doesn't